Well, it's a joy to be here, and the remainder of the children's choir who are here must take back to all the others just what a pleasure it was to hear them sing. Thank you very much indeed for singing, and if ever we could just take you in a big, big bag back to London, all of you. And then next week in London, you could stand in front of the congregation at Wesley's Chapel and sing what you've just sung. Why, that would be fantastic. So thank you for doing that. Of course, I thank the choir, but they'll understand on this occasion, needs must. I must thank them. That doesn't imply that I don't thank you, of course. It's just a joy to be here. I know choirs from this part of the world have come to London from time to time, and it's always a joy to see them. This is a beautiful sanctuary, and the fact that it's 75 years old just reminds me that it dates from those last days before Pearl Harbor and the entry of America to the Second World War. I have here on my stole a little red insignia that indicates that I'm a canon of St. Paul's Cathedral in London. I know it doesn't look important enough for that. I've often said to people that it looks like one of those buttons you push if you're in a care home, if you want a nurse to come to take you to the toilet. But it's actually a sign of the fact that I'm a canon of St. Paul's Cathedral, and if anyone were ever there and could come with me behind the high altar at St. Paul's, where there's a chapel dedicated to those who died in the to those American service men and women who died in the Second World War, and where every single day a page is turned, revealing four more columns with about 40 people in each column of those who died in the Second World War. They are remembered faithfully in that American chapel of remembrance. And on Thanksgiving Day, the American ambassador will come. The cathedral will be full of Americans living in Britain for a service of thanksgiving on that special day. And, of course, this was built in the last days before all of that happened. And it's a very beautiful place, and I feel proud to have been invited to preach here. I have to say that the tone and angle of view of what I'm about to say will be looking back over my shoulder, for part of it anyway, towards the 1960s. You see, I'm here at the invitation of Roger Irison, and he's sitting out there trying to look as if he's not there, but he is. And he was once General Secretary of the Board of the United Methodist Church for Higher Education. And in the 1960s, he was studying for his PhD in Cambridge. And I was a student there at the same time, and we became friends way back then. 50 years ago, it shows less on me than it does on him. But for all that, it's made me really reflect on the 1960s and what a formative decade it was for me, and indeed a shaping moment, I would say, for the Christian communities around the world. So many energies were released in that decade. So many questions were raised in that decade. So many challenges were put to communities of faith. When Roger came to Cambridge, he was alongside a whole school of theologians, most of whom he rejected, that were suggesting that God was dead. When asked, "What do you think about God being dead?" One of my friends answered quite calmly that he didn't know he'd been ill. The 1960s was very formative for me. In 1960 itself, I became an undergraduate. I then had 10 years in higher education myself. And at the end of that time, curiously, now, as a Methodist minister being sent wherever, my wife and I, just married, were sent to Haiti. So 10 years in higher education, with a couple of degrees under my belt and a teaching career too, we were sent to a country where 75% of the people are illiterate. It served us right. And it was a 10-year period there of immense growth spiritually for me. So the 1960s began when I had no faith. I had not yet submitted to be a Christian, and it ended with my being a missionary to Haiti. During that time also, in 1961, the New English Bible was published. I had only known the authorized version, as we call it in England, but I'm always delighted and touched at the fact that it's more regularly known as the King James Bible here, because, of course, it just reminds me of how fond you are of English kings. And it was the New English Bible that blew my mind open and introduced possibilities of faith that I had never thought of before. Now, I've reflected on that as far as the first of the two scripture passages, the one from the second letter to the Corinthians, is concerned at the earlier service. What I want to do now is reflect on the impact of the second one, the passage from the Gospel, how it affected me and really impelled me, made me aware that I could no longer escape the responsibility of making some serious choices. What does it profit a man if he gain the whole world at the cost of his true self? What can he give to buy that self back again? Of course, the version you have in front of you has recognized the impact of feminist theology in the intervening years, and we now have gender-inclusive language in that passage. But in 1961, we weren't yet there, which is why I just quoted it in the version I remember from those days. It's a haunting question. As well as reading the New English Bible, I was also studying English literature. And I remember reading Christopher Marlowe's Dr. Faustus at that time for the very first time. In that play, from the same age, of course, of English literature as William Shakespeare, Dr. Faustus, who is a formidably learned man, is not satisfied with the mastery of the discipline he's given himself to, but wants to know a lot more. Indeed, he wants to have power over every discipline. So he does a deal with Mephistopheles, the devil, that he shall have command of every discipline there is, the law, medicine, theology, philosophy. And he will be able to command Mephistopheles to run at his command for 24 years. It'll be a contract signed in his own blood. But at the end of that 24 years, he recognizes that he will have to pay for the privileges he will have enjoyed, and that he will then be entirely at the disposal of Mephistopheles. And the play unfolds the drama of someone who at one moment is mighty and powerful, calls all the shots, commands his field, does what he likes. And as the time towards that end point draws near, is in an agony of mind. And I don't think there's much to rival the conclusion at midnight on the day in question as portrayed in Christopher Marlowe's play. I'll read just a line or two. It's intervened by stage directions. I will endeavor to drop my voice a little when they come so that you can distinguish between the words that are being spoken by Faustus and the instructions that are given by the playwright. The clock strikes 12. Oh, it strikes, it strikes. Now, body, turn to air, or Lucifer will bear thee quick to hell. Thunder and lightning. O soul, be charged and changed into little water drops and fall into the ocean, never again to be found. My God, look not so fierce on me. Enter devils. Adders and serpents, let me breathe a while. Ugly hell, gape not. Come not, Lucifer. I'll burn my books, O Mephistopheles. Exeunt, they leave with him. Epilogue. Cut is the branch that might have grown full straight. It is a terrifying prospect. Preachers can't stand in pulpits like this anymore and preach hellfire. I grew up in Wales, where, boy, the preacher could hold you over the brim of sulfur and steaming bad stuff and keep you there dangling until you squirmed, until they got a response from you that was born both of fear and dread. I've known that kind of preaching. Can't get away with it any longer. Pity, really. There's a few people I'd quite like to hold right there. But in the absence of a belief in hell as a place somewhere underneath, we simply have not to throw out something at the heart of the teaching about hell that we must continue to contend with. It is that we may gain the whole world, our businesses may prosper, our families may increase, we may achieve positions of power, we may have all things. And yet, if we put our confidence in what we have achieved in those ways, we will have missed something mighty important. First of all, the things that we put our trust in can be taken from us as quickly as we ever got them. Secondly, we can be smitten by something which makes them seem trivial. How many people have I seen in sickness who, for all that they have, are not able to put right the position they find themselves in? I don't just mean a cancer or an incurable disease. I mean a psychological state of total, utter despair, facing blackness, questions they can't answer. Now, I don't believe in a physical place of hell, but I've seen people in hell. And we somehow have to rescue ourselves from overly relying on the fruits and energies of our own self-generated effort. It's a difficult message to preach in a self-made country where entrepreneurial activity and making things happen is in the cultural DNA. But I would urge all of you to beware, not to diminish the energy or the enterprise, but the tendency to be seduced by success itself and forget the giver of the energy, the provider of the universe, the creator of the world. Jesus invited the person who might be tempted to believe that having gained the whole world, he'd won life's battle, suggested that it was more about carrying his cross and denying himself. For years, I got this verse, I think, wrong. With the knowledge, looking over one's shoulder, that we have, namely that Jesus died on the cross, this mention of a cross before Jesus dies is not perhaps about the fact that if you follow Jesus, you're going to end up on a hill outside Jerusalem on a cross. But it does mean that the cross that Jesus was bearing, which became a physical cross, was the cross of responsibility. He was dedicated to a message of love. And the pressures he was under might squeeze that love out of him. He was totally dedicated to it and would be till the end, even as he died. Love and sorrow mingled and flowed down from the cross. Taking one's cross and denying oneself means accepting that at the heart of one's life there should be the principle of sacrifice. If you imagine yourself at a crossroads with a signpost giving contraindicatory signals, this one says self-fulfillment, and this one says self-sacrifice. And if you imagine that Jesus has in some way turned this one to face the same way as that one, that self-sacrifice, the capacity not to be in chains to your possessions, not to be prisoners of your success, the capacity to sacrifice yourself, to share your wealth, to do something altruistic, is not a course of action that diminishes you, but which actually gives you a sense of what life is and can be all about. That self-sacrifice leads to self-fulfillment and Christian perfection. Ah, perfection. Nobody's been perfect. What's he talking about? Well, William Barclay, the old Bible commentator, used to say that if a carpenter has a range of tools that he wants to use for a particular job, he has a number of chisels, and he'll choose the one that's absolutely right because he's an experienced carpenter to do the particular job that he has in mind. And the fact that he can choose the right one gives that tool perfection at that moment. It's the perfect instrument for what he wants to achieve. I do remember on this question of perfection that a friend of mine once just said to a congregation like this one, perfect? Nobody's perfect. There's nobody here who can say that he's perfect. I dare you. Is there anybody here who can say he's perfect? And a little man in a shabby raincoat at the back stood up. What? You're claiming to be perfect? Well, not exactly, he said. I'm standing proxy for my wife's first husband. But Christian perfection is part of the Methodist theological legacy. And it doesn't mean that you are flawless, but it means that you set your feet on the road marked self-sacrifice, self-fulfillment. If you should give yourself to the idols of this world, to the fruits of your labors, and please let me emphasize again, I have no quibble with people being successful. But I have seen too many people then turn what they're successful at into their raison d'etre and the purpose of their lives. Then it becomes very seductive and very, very problematical. What can you give to buy that self back again? Modern literature, modern philosophy is all preoccupied with the question of identity. Who am I? Who are you? Who are you? Scratch away at all the stuff that you put in a CV or on Facebook or whatever. Take all that away. Who are you? Who are you where God sees who you are? Who are you fundamentally in yourself? Or have you forgotten how to look for yourself? How you prefer the facade of yourself you put out for general consumption? Well, money won't do it. I remember in my young years, when I was a professor, and I'd have loved an academic life. I have advocated causes all my life, and someone said to me, why don't you become a lawyer, an advocate? I've been involved with journalists for 30 years. I write for newspapers. I broadcast for the BBC on television and radio. Why don't you become a journalist? And I'm in Parliament, and I sit on political benches with political companions. And people say, you're a Methodist minister, why don't you become a politician where you can do things? Well, there's a lot of politicians I know who can't do nothing. I am one of Mr. Wesley's preachers. I earn the same as my secretary. There is no more liberated person in this church because I know that the decisions I made way back are the ones that have fulfilled me and kept me believing all down the decades. I've worked in Haiti, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, 75% of the people illiterate. There was an earthquake there 5 years ago. More people died in Haiti in 5 minutes than have died in Syria in 5 years. Think of that. I remember going to Haiti 2 weeks after the earthquake with the leader of the Muslim Council of Britain. Muslims in Britain had raised more money than anybody else for the poor people of Haiti. And the chief executive of the Muslim Council of Britain wanted to go just to, as an act of solidarity, but he knew he'd be accused of proselytizing. So he said, "You're a Christian leader, come with me. Let's double front it." And so I went with Sheikh Ibrahim Mogra, and the two of us went just to show our solidarity with the people of Haiti. I remember going with a small group of people into one of the camps that the people were displaced into, 150,000 of them. People say there's still 100,000 there. What on earth's happening to all that money that's gone to Haiti? Do you know that 1,400,000 have been rehoused? But of course, people will always see the ones who haven't been. Well, in this camp, what a miserable place on a day like this. By the way, thank you for organizing an English day for us to come. I mean, it just shows that Mark Williams has Welsh blood in him that he can pull such a grey day out of the air like that. But it was just like this. On that day, we went into that camp. And as I went around, I was the only one who could speak the local language. And so I had to do the talking to people. And I hated it. What could I talk to them about? They had nothing. Absolutely nothing. These well-fed people coming in to ask them intervening and nosy questions, what on earth is that all about? It's diminishing, it's patronizing, it's horrible. But I got to one tent and I sat down. I knew I had to do it, and so I did. And there's this woman sitting there on a small stool. She has a baby on her lap and a little bundle of clothing in the corner of the tent. There's a ground sheet. The tent is broken and lets the weather in. And she is totally, totally miserable. She resents the fact that we've entered the only space that she has. I tried to put her at her ease. "I'm so sorry," I said. "I really am. I won't be long. People just want to know how you are, that's all." And I thought I'd ask her what her name was. "Qui Jean Ourele?" I said. "What's your name?" And she mumbled something resentfully from a sour face. And I must have got it wrong. I thought it was Sonia. When I said it to her, she could let me know with her facial gestures what she thought of me, and it wasn't much. "So I'm really, really sorry I got it wrong. Tell me again, what is your name? I just want to know who you are." "Julia," she said. That's what I thought she said. And when I repeated it back to her, it was clear that once again I'd drawn a blank. Poor woman, even now I shrink at the thought of what I was putting her through. I said, "Look, I've got it wrong twice. One last go, and then I'll go, I promise." And she said it again, and I heard it, "Djula." And when I said "Djula" back to her, which was correct, what a transformation. I called her by her name. The lights went on in her eyes again. Her face broke into a smile. She told me off for being deaf and stupid. She welcomed me into her space, and a human being was born all over again. And all it took was telling her her name. You know, when you have primordial experiences of that kind, all the priorities we set for ourselves are shaken into a different configuration. All I want to do with the people I meet is bring a smile to their face, is to have a moment of recognition pass between us, a mutual acknowledgement. All I want by putting an arm around someone's shoulder is for them to believe that the next day, which they were fearing so much, they can face after all. The gestures are so simple. The opportunities are manifold. But life rushes us off our feet. We have no time. We've sold our souls too easily and too cheaply to the goods and material matters of this world. And all the time, those smiles, the light in people's eyes, The courage you can give people is all there waiting to happen. What can you give to buy that self back again? So as I leave you and disappear by plane into the miserable American sky and regain the wonderful promised land bathed in sunshine, which is called London, I shall leave you with that thought. Be as successful as you like, my friends. Make as much money as you can, but never let it put you in its clutches. There's far more to life than that. Amen.